Now, from the left coast to the D.C. Beltway, covering the topics you love to hate and hate to miss, it's the Silk or Joe Show.
Welcome, everybody. Welcome to the Silk or Joe Show. Co-host Joe here. Happy to be with you all this Saturday afternoon. I'm going to run through the introductions because we have a guest on hold right now. But as the Silk or Joe Show always does, we want to thank the Main Street Radio Network for allowing this program to exist. We wouldn't be here without them. And, you know, that's because their sponsors, too, kind of get on them about the content, but they always have our backs. Appreciate them supporting our First Amendment rights. And we also want to thank the Salem Radio Network for distributing this show. Main Street Radio Network can be found at mainstreetradionetwork.com and also on social media, Main Street Radio Network on Facebook and on Twitter as well. Also, the Silk or Joe Show can be found on Getter, GETTR.com, at Silk or Joe Show. All right, ran right through that, and we are joined now by Jennifer Say. She is an American author, filmmaker, business executive, 1986 USA Gymnastics National Champion, seven-time member of the U.S. Women's National Team, and also produced the 2020 Emmy Award-winning documentary film Athlete A, with her latest book being Levi's Unbuttoned. The woke mob took my job but gave me my voice. Jennifer Say, happy to have you. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing fine. Thank you. Happy to have you. So tell us about your book, Levi's Unbuttoned. What's this all about?
Yeah, well, I worked at Levi's for almost 23 years. I made my way up from an entry-level marketing assistant to global brand president and candidate for CEO. By all accounts, I was a pretty well-liked employee. But in March 2020, I started to push back on the widespread school closures. Public schools shut down nationally in March of 2020. They remained shut for half of America's children for more than a year. And I thought this was wrong. It was harmful. I thought it would be harmful to children. We've now seen that that is the case. Private schools opened. Public schools stayed closed. I was astonished that, you know, folks went along with this, at the inequity of this, the inequality. And I was very outspoken about it, about the harms done to children from all the restrictions, including, you know, masking very young children in schools, which interferes with the educational and developmental process, to vaccine mandates in schools and all of it. And in January of this year, I was told, because of my outspokenness, that there was no longer a place for me at the company. And rather than accept the severance that was offered to me, which was significant, I did not want to sign a non-disclosure agreement. I chose to quit. And that is what the book is about, essentially.
Wow. And just the fact that it happened earlier this year, after a lot of science had been done on the problems with masking and keeping kids in out of schools. And it's crazy that they would just pick that time. When I first saw this description of what happened, I thought, oh, this must have been in 2020 in the thick of the pandemic.
Oh, no.
But no, it was well after.
Oh yeah. It was in January of this year, and I publicly resigned in February. But it's hard to overstate. I lived in San Francisco for over 30 years, and I lived there while this was all going on. I now live in Denver. But it's hard to overstate the, you know, manufacturing of consensus that happened in these places. And if you strayed at all from that artificial consensus, which was, you know, created by censoring people, essentially, if you strayed from that, you were vilified, you were demonized. And, you know, I was called all sorts of unemployable names. I was deemed to be a racist for wanting schools open. And, you know, no company wants to have a racist as their brand president. I was viewed to be a reputational risk and harmful to the business. And so they pushed me out, even as recently as, you know, January 2022. And I would argue now, even though there is widespread agreement that the school closures were harmful, if you dare to point out that there needs to be accountability for that, that people actually made those decisions, that was a policy decision, you know, you're still demonized.
Yeah, it's incredible how there's just this refusal to anyone to not only take responsibility, but to even abide by what the science says at this point, and just especially coming out in January of this year. And I got to tell you, you have children of your own, so you've really been feeling the impact of these lockdowns. So it's like they're firing a mother who can speak firsthand to what's going on here. You'd think that she would know, of all people, what the effects are, but no, they just kick you out.
Yeah, I mean, I have four children, a wide range of ages, from 6 all the way up to 22. So I experienced firsthand the impact to, you know, very young children as well as older children. But, you know, I've not hidden the fact I was an executive. I certainly would be considered privileged. And you know, my children certainly suffered less than most. But the fact is, in San Francisco public schools, 60% of the children are low income. So the most vulnerable children were the ones being harmed. And I really felt it was important to speak up for them. But again, if you veered at all from whatever the party line was, you had to be silenced. And I think that the silencing has such a chilling effect because it prevented other people. You know, they couldn't get me to stop speaking out, but it certainly prevented other people from doing so. And again, that creates this manufactured consensus that everyone agrees, that schools need to be closed. And I risked exposing the hypocrisy of the leaders in the company who were sending their own children to in-person private school. And therefore, I needed to go.
Now, leading up to this, in your storied career with Levi's before this, did you see any indication that the corporate culture was this oppressive, for lack of a better word?
You know what? It started to kind of, like I said, I was there for over 22 years. I certainly started to see it emerge in sort of 2018, that if you were going to speak out on any issues, they had to be aligned with this sort of woke position or the positions held by the Democratic Party. And I should say, I was of the left for many, many years, all of my adult life. Until recently, I would consider myself an independent voter now or unaffiliated. And it just became more and more oppressive. But here's the thing. I had been very outspoken about social issues and political issues in the past, but I had upheld the views that the company was espousing. And I learned very quickly that if you violate that, there is no longer a place for you. But, you know, it presented itself in all sorts of ways, not just the pushback on my advocacy. There were all sorts of other things that were going on. We were getting feedback on certain, you know, celebrities and influencers that we hired. Feedback is a nice way to put it. But from employees, for instance, we had one influencer that we used who was a fashion blogger out of New York. He was Israeli, and he didn't really talk about the politics of Israel, but he had an Israeli flag in his profile. And there was an outcry that we should not work for him because the position of the left now is pretty anti-Israel. And so I started to feel it over and over again. And in my final years at the company, I found myself, you know, with little bandwidth to actually do what my job is or was to drive the business. I was fielding all of these social and political issues. Don't work with this person, you know, weigh in on this issue. And I saw the madness approaching, and it really accelerated starting in 2020. With the pandemic, but also with the protests in the summer of 2020, when every company was all too eager to prove their woke bona fides, it became clear at that point that if you veer at all from that orthodoxy, there is not a place for you in any company in America.
Wow. And I have to wonder, you mentioned that the focus on all these issues kept you away from actually doing your job. Did that affect the brand at all? Did that affect business at all?
Well, you know, I mean, the business was challenged during the pandemic. We, in the early days, in the first 6 months, you know, 80% of our stores were closed across the world. So that certainly impacted our business. But we emerged quite strong from that because of the strength of the brand. Levi's is a beloved brand around the world. And so you know, my argument internally was that it would affect us internally if we didn't get back to focusing on the business, making the best product, marketing it, you know, honestly to consumers, and that we needed to really manage closely how much we were weighing in all these issues because it is a business distraction. And I think, you know, we've seen this a little bit in recent days with or weeks with the Disney situation and their CEO Chapek being pushed out. You know, lots of folks like argue that it's because he kind of weighed in on these issues with DeSantis and the bill there. But I think his focus on going to war with the governor of Florida was a distraction from the business. And I think ultimately he was pushed out because the business wasn't performing. And so all these companies, I think, just need to get back to what I call normie capitalism, which is focus on the things that drive your business. Make a great product, market in a way that people want, treat employees fairly. That's it. Let's get back to basics.
All right, Jennifer Stay, appreciate you being on the Silk or Joe Show today. Real quick, Levi's and Button, the woke mob took my job but gave me my voice. Where quickly do I get a copy? Oop. I guess, folks, Levi's and Button, the woke mob took my job but gave me my voice. Find it where books are sold.
This report is sponsored by Meta. This holiday season, Meta is excited to announce new ways to make a difference. When you sign up to donate monthly to a nonprofit on Facebook, Meta will match your donation after the second month. Meta will match up to $7 million in total across all organizations in celebration of giving season. In addition to connecting with nonprofits, people use Meta's platforms every day to connect with individuals, groups, and businesses. Also, this holiday season, Upworthy is inviting people to share their most extraordinary stories of connection on Meta's products, like Instagram, Facebook, WhatsApp, and more. Submissions can be about experiencing a random act of kindness, finding your chosen family, or coming together with like-minded people to do something you never thought would be possible. Upworthy may highlight select stories. The holidays are about giving back, and a small connection you make online could make a huge difference in the world. Meta is looking forward to helping connect people this holiday season and beyond by making the ordinary feel extraordinary. For more information, visit facebook.com/upworthy or instagram.com/upworthy.
As shopping deals ramp up ahead of the holidays, criminals are working extra hard to steal Americans' money. Kathy Stokes is Director of Fraud Prevention Programs at AARP.
76% of U.S. consumers have experienced or been targeted by fraud tied to the holiday season. A lot of fraud happens online, and this is a big concern with two-thirds of consumers planning to shop online this holiday season.
Scammers target everyone, regardless of age. Data show that younger adults experience fraud more often than older adults, so it's important for every shopper to know the signs of fraud.
Don't click on links in emails or texts, and the same goes for hot deals with online ads. Scammers will use links to try to misdirect you. If a retailer contacts you about a, quote, problem and asks for your login information, it is a scam, full stop.
To learn more, visit aarp.org/fraudwatchnetwork or call the free helpline at 877-908-3360.
My name is Judy Teeter, and I'm the mother of three boys. My youngest, Joe, was a great kid. He loved sports, music, and his youth group. One day, Joe asked me to drive him to an after-school event, which was about a mile from our home. I was driving through a green light when a car in cross traffic ran a red light and drove right into the side of our car, killing Joe. The driver was talking on her phone, so she never even saw the red light. She was so absorbed in her phone call. Before the crash, I didn't realize just talking on a cell phone while driving was so dangerous. Now it's something I think about every day. According to the National Safety Council, about 1 in 4 car crashes involves a cell phone. Hands-free is no safer. When you're behind the wheel, put away your phone. For Joe and for the thousands of needless deaths every year, remember, there is no safe way to talk on a cell phone while driving. Find out more at nsc.org/callskill.
Adopt US Kids presents Multiple Choice Parenting.
Your daughter just had her first breakup. Do you A, put yourself in her shoes?
How could he do this to you? And for Sheila, she has split ends.
B, console her.
Oh, sweetie, this is going to happen a lot. 4, maybe 5 more times before you get married.
C, take charge.
Got to get this all straightened out. Give me a little talking to man, mano a mano.
Hey, Steve. It's now a good time?
No? Okay, no problem. Bye.
Or D, help her find a new boyfriend?
I know a great place to meet boys. The internet. Nice, single boys. Never mind. How about some ice cream?
As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
I make a special appeal to social media companies and media outlets. Please deal with the misinformation and disinformation that's on your shows. It has to stop.
We have to get tighter. We have to get better at communicating. And frankly, the tech companies have to stop allowing specific individuals over and over again to spread disinformation. That's what the fossil fuel companies pay for. That's what folks who make money out of fossil fuels and don't make money and don't care about saving consumers' costs. That's what they do. We have to be smarter than that. And we need the tech companies to really jump in.
We are in regular touch with these social media platforms, and those engagements typically happen through members of our senior staff. In terms of actions, Alex, that we have taken, or we're working to take, I should say, from the federal government, we've increased disinformation research and tracking within the Surgeon General's office. We're flagging problematic posts for Facebook that spread disinformation. There are also proposed changes that we have made to social media platforms. One, that they measure and publicly share the impact of misinformation on their platform. Second, that we have recommended, proposed that they create a robust enforcement strategy that bridges their properties and provides transparency about the rules. There's about 12 people who are producing 65% of anti-vaccine misinformation on social media platforms. All of them remain active on Facebook, despite some even being banned on other platforms, including Facebook, ones that Facebook owns. Third, it's important to take faster action against harmful posts. Finally, we have proposed they promote quality information sources in their feed.
A question about Twitter. There's a researcher at Stanford who says that this is a critical moment, really, in terms of ensuring that Twitter does not become a vector for misinformation. I mean, are you concerned about Elon Musk says there's more and more subscribers coming online. Are you concerned about that? And what tools do you have? Who is it at the White House that is really keeping track of this?
So look, this is something that we're certainly keeping an eye on. And look, we have always been very clear and that when it comes to social media platforms, it is their responsibility to make sure that when it comes to misinformation, when it comes to the hate that we're seeing, that they take action, that they continue to take action. Again, we're all keeping a close eye on this.
All right, welcome back to the Silk Road Show, everybody. I was about to say Alan Nathan Show, because what you just heard was a montage of clips that I played earlier this week on the Alan Nathan Show. You hear President Joe Biden calling for social media and big tech platforms to censor people they don't like. Then you hear the White House climate advisor, Gina McCarthy, saying, do the same thing, censor anyone we don't like, followed by the White House press secretary at the time, Jen Psaki, saying that they need to, that they are actually, she's describing how they are censoring people that they don't like. They're getting with Facebook and Twitter and all these big tech platforms, flagging alleged vaccine misinformation. But this clip is coming out in June 15, 2021. At that time, vaccine misinformation was considered to be, if you came out and said, if you take the vaccine, you will still can get COVID. That was considered misinformation at the time. That's the sort of thing they were reaching out to ban from Twitter, which is not only dangerous just medically, but for the average person's health, but dangerous to science in general, because that was a fact, as Joe Biden himself found out later that year, that's a fact. You can, in fact, get COVID while still vaccinated. However, at the time, that's the sort of misinformation they were trying to ban from social media, because they, heaven forbid that scientific discourse get out there and the public have to make up their own minds based on the facts available, whether or not that they've all been confirmed or not. So then you also have the current White House press secretary, talking about how they're still monitoring Twitter for censorship reasons. And she was asked by, of all people, a reporter from the Associated Press. Now, you might recall how reporters from the Associated Press and everyone else were making such a big stink about Trump being a danger to the First Amendment. Here they are asking the Biden administration to censor people just based on what the Biden administration defines as misinformation and dangerous information and all that. But repeatedly, what they define as misinformation turns out to be fact. Again, using the vaccine example, dangerous misinformation that if you get the vaccine, you can still get COVID. That's what they consider dangerous misinformation. They also consider dangerous misinformation to discuss any side effects the vaccine might have. Blood clots, strokes, heart attacks, all sorts of stuff have been happening to people who get the vaccine. And we've just seen an actual surge in people dying of blood clots and strokes, heart attacks, well before they should. 30-year-olds, teenagers, 17-year-olds, 20-year-olds, just any age group, we've seen a surge of deaths. And as you heard me talking with Art Moore the other day on the Alan Nathan Show, reporter from WorldNet Daily, about a renowned oncologist in England who was talking about how there's surges in deaths now after the vaccines were introduced, that he's seeing direct links to them. You're not allowed to discuss stuff like that, even if it turns out to be absolutely 100% correct. You're just not allowed to bring it up because the Biden administration defined it as misinformation. Politicians decided what medical science is. It's like they're terrified of what facts and the truth are. And for take it to a political direction, the Hunter Biden laptop story, we saw how that worked. In 2020, like probably millions of voters, based on what the polls showed, would not have voted for Joe Biden if they had heard about that laptop story. So again, censorship and misinformation on behalf of the administration, on behalf of a political party, and that's been going on for quite some time. It's dangerous politically, dangerous medically, and it's still going on, and they still haven't learned anything. In fact, that's been part of the backlash against Elon Musk taking over Twitter, because they know he's not going to play ball with him as much as they want him to, and he's not going to censor as much as they want him to. That's been the whole big stink about Musk taking over Twitter there. And again, they're not censoring mistruths and misinformation. They're censoring actual facts. Now, you shouldn't really censor misinformation anyway, because you never really know what could be true and who is as fallible as humans are. I'm pretty sure only God can actually decide what constitutes misinformation and untruths at this point. So just it's best to let an intelligent public decide for themselves what they should be, what is fact and what is not. And of course, you need an intelligent public in order to decide that. But, we're working on that, I guess, or working away from it based on what we were talking about in the last segment. However, as far as champions of free speech go, the Republicans aren't going to be of much help, because it seems that their party is also on board with some misinformation being censored. You have the House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy, for example. He came out a while ago saying that he wanted people saying that they saw election fraud censored off Twitter, wondering, can't we ban those accounts? And he was very frustrated that these people were allowed to express their opinions and views, and I guess express what their constituents reported to them, because none of this stuff came out of thin air. Okay, it's not like Trump just said, you know what, I lost the election, therefore I'm willing to lie about why. This stuff came from witnesses on the ground, people who saw crazy stuff happening to them, crazy stuff that should be investigated. But no, because it happened to be helpful to Trump, nothing of the kind happened. Meanwhile, you have Democrat after Democrat denying that elections were fair and just, and yet they're not considered conspiracy theorists at all. Heck, Hakeem Jeffries, they just voted for him to lead the Democrats in the next House session. And you know what? He is an election denier, too. He denied in the past that elections were free and fair and said that there was perfidy going on. They voted him into a leadership position. Yet, when Trump says it, that you have to deny it all, even if people aside from Trump are saying they saw stuff. And we've had them on the show before, people aside from Trump who said they've seen stuff. It's crazy what becomes misinformation when you have the wrong people in charge of deciding. Folks, more Silk or Joe Show after this break.
With the holidays back in full swing, there's a lot of pressure to be the perfect host or hostess with the mostest. To help you pull off those holiday gatherings and make the season brighter and more manageable, here's celebrity pastry chef Duff Goldman.
So I'm not only a baking enthusiast, but I'm also a raisin fan. Now, it's almost impossible to find snacks that taste great, but they're also made with whole fruit. Now, to help you pull off the holidays this year, I've put together four recipes that really kind of showcase the versatility of sun-made dried fruit. Challah, biscotti, lamb, and a truce cookie.
Pulling off the holidays means catering to all of the family's needs and wants. It's about compromises. It's about truces. It's about cookies.
The oatmeal raisin cookie versus chocolate chip cookie debate is pretty polarizing. I've teamed up with Sunmade to launch the truce cookie. Half oatmeal raisin, half chocolate chip? Sounds like the ultimate cookie to me.
To view all of Duff's holiday recipes, visit sunmade.com/pullofftheholidays.
We've got some great toys for the kids on your list. We're going to start with the Play-Doh Kitchen Creations Ultimate Ice Cream Truck Playset from Hasbro. Make all kinds of great make-believe ice cream. Super fun. Then for arts and crafts, the Crayola Light Up Tracing Pad. Trace the picture and then create your own artwork. $24.99 for ages 6 and up. And then the house monsters. Whirly lives in your washing machine. Blushy lives in your bathroom. These are great collectibles, and they help kids deal with monsters and have a good time with them. We're also going to celebrate diversity with the Fresh Dolls from Dr. Lisa Williams and World of EPR. This is the Freshfinity and Fresh Squad. These are great dolls with authentic hair colors, authentic skin colors, beautiful fashions, and much more. Tamagotchi Nano is a great handheld based on the original Tamagotchi from 1996. These miniature games have things from Disney Toy Story, Tiny Tan, which is based on BTS, and so many others. Get ready to ride. This is the Disney Princess Playdate Maximus. It's from the movie Tangled. Stands up, kids up to 70 pounds can sit on it. All kinds of interaction. This is one we've had a blast with. This is Ruckus FX from Just Play. What you're going to do is punch, swipe, twist, and flick to create all kinds of sound that you can mix. It's about $49.99 from Just Play. And then since 1964, the Hess truck has been a huge hit. This is the Hess toy truck with hot rods, all kinds of great lights and sounds, super fun to play with. And don't forget the Squishmallows from Jazzwares. These are one of the hottest things out there. All this and more at thetoyguy.com.
The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. At Children International, we know that the journey to end poverty for good begins first with a child. It starts with their first checkup, lesson, opportunity, job. That journey takes commitment from people like you and me to end poverty for good. Learn more at children.org.
Hi, it's Practical Polly's radio show.
If you're just figuring out that healthier cooking oils are better than solid fats, you may be asking, now what am I going to do with all these tubs of lard? Ever had one of those moments when your favorite skinny jeans feel too tightly tailored? Generously apply lard to your hips and thighs and those fancy pants will slide on like a dream. Or here's a family-friendly idea. How about making your yard into a lard fun park? Frost your driveway with a nice thick coating and give those kiddos a downhill thrill no matter what time of year. Having a bad hair day? Yep. A little lump of lard can tame your flyaways in a jiffy. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste or to your waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils, like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Now that's a tip worth keeping for life. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
The mission of Paralyzed Veterans of America is clear. Accessibility. Veterans who have served and sacrificed the best of themselves deserve access to the best our country has to offer. Access to meaningful employment. Access to the veterans' benefits they've earned. Accessible homes and vehicles. And access to every part of their communities. With PVA staff working inside VA hospitals, no other veterans organization has provided more real-time, ongoing support for paralyzed veterans and their families. PVA is proud to serve veterans across all branches, all generations, and all conflicts. Our nation's heroes fought for your independence. Join PVA in fighting for theirs at pva.org.
Welcome back to the Silkworm Joe Show, everybody. So, as we look at what the chaos that's going on in China, these anti-lockdown protests, I would say it's not chaos in a good way at this point, because you have the Chinese government, the way they're cracking down on the protesters and sending in, of all things, these, they look like the government chasing ET or something, the way they're dressed in these hazmat suits or whatever, as they chase down the protesters and attack them. Sometimes the protesters are able to repel them, other times they aren't. And that's because the Chinese government's zero COVID policy, where I guess even the riot police have to be decked out like they're stepping into Chernobyl or something when they pursue rioting anti-lockdown protesters. And this started because the Chinese lockdowns were much more intense than we experienced here in America. They go on randomly, they'll just pop up overnight. You have no warning whatsoever. You know, it's like a game of musical chairs almost with where you're at when the lockdowns strike. And then they weld you. They actually weld bars on the windows and weld the doors shut to make sure you cannot escape your building. And as you might imagine, it's very hard to get welded bars, to get food through them, to get medications through them, to get a doctor through them if you are sick with something that isn't COVID. In fact, they probably wouldn't let a doctor in if you were sick with something other than COVID. You're not allowed to have anything. A lot of people die because of that. Starvation, preventable medical conditions. And what set this off, this latest round of protests, was an apartment complex burned down. 10 people burned to death inside their own homes because the Chinese government welded them into those homes. The thing is, though, the Americans over here, we haven't really learned much from that policy, because right now you have people like at the Washington Post, Taylor Lorenz, defending the Chinese lockdown policies. Dr. Fauci defended the Chinese lockdown policies just the other day after all this had happened. He said, well, if these intensive lockdowns are to encourage everyone to get vaccines, then I'm all for them. He said he's all for welding people inside burning buildings if it convinces the masses to get a vaccine. What kind of psychopath is he? Well, I guess we saw that during the pandemic, didn't we? His repeated lies, his repeated refusals to own up to the lies that he told. And now he's advocating welding people inside burning buildings if it terrorizes others to get vaccines. I tell you, Big Pharma, when they donate to him, they really got their money's worth for that guy. He is terrible. Monster. Did we inherit him from the Nazis or something? Gee whiz, he seems Italian, but Mussolini didn't have anyone this bad in his team. So, but the people here, our elites here, they're talking about how, oh, we should still go back to lockdowns, doing lockdowns, shouldn't get rid of doing lockdowns. And again, the Washington Post's Taylor Lorenz outright said we should never have ended them, and China had the right policy with welding people inside burning buildings. So with those kinds of people running our government right now, is it any wonder that the Biden administration isn't really criticizing the Chinese government? Think about it. Look what they've done so far. They are in favor of, a lot of Democrats are in favor, leftists at least, are in favor of this lockdown type policy here that triggered these protests, as we've seen by the reactions to criticism of the Chinese policies. Then also the Biden administration itself, they're known for cracking down on protesters a time or two. For example, you might recall last year how when parents were protesting critical race theory being taught in their schools, that is this idea that whites are horrible, just genetically programmed to be horrible people, and blacks and non-whites are just programmed genetically to be victims, and so all of them should vote Democrat because they will be empowered, or they will assuage their guilt or whatever. That's pretty much the gist of critical race theory there. Well, when parents started protesting that kind of thing being taught because they saw either their kids being vilified or their kids being told that they're helpless in life when they aren't, well, the Biden administration just couldn't stomach that. So they had the FBI investigating parents as if they were terrorists. And they did that by ordering some teachers group or whatever to just write this letter to them saying that parents were threatening them. It wasn't the case. The government ordered this teachers group to do that, and the teachers group complied with that order. And then the government used this letter that they ordered the teachers group to write as justification for investigating parents as terrorists. And then the attorney general who engineered all of this, well, it turns out his son-in-law profits heavily from trading critical race theory textbooks. Millions of dollars are online for him. So that's the sort of thing you see over in communist China right now. I don't know why we call it communist. They're more like unrestrained capitalism with just the government in control of it. It's more like fascism, if anything else, if you ask me. They sort of dropped the communism charade in the 70s after it had murdered many of their citizens, millions of them, in fact. But now the policy they've adopted is still totalitarian in nature. It's just of a different kind. And to their credit, it's less death, but that's not saying much. Well, that's a very low bar to meet in civilized worlds. So I guess it's no wonder we still consider them developing. But the point is, though, How far off are we when, you know, the Chinese are just more open about it. They roll tanks on the protesters. We just roll the FBI on protesters. In fact, after the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, we saw various pro-life groups who had been protesting. Suddenly the FBI is raiding pro-life protesters for no reason other than they are pro-life. For example, there was Mark Houck. There was some conflict between him and an abortion protester. It was resolved. The local police saw nothing to it, gave him a light charge or whatever, so he was charged for it. But then the FBI rolled in, pointed guns at his family, and dragged him out of his house. It's not like he wouldn't have cooperated with them or anything. That wasn't the case at all. They showed up in force and leaked documents. And according to the FBI whistleblowers, this is deliberate on the part of the FBI. They know they don't have really a case against him. They just decided to roll up and point guns at his family as to warn off anyone else. This was just a show of force to warn off any other one. If you're pro-life, shut up or we'll do this to you. That's what whistleblowers from the FBI have said. So again, this is the sort of thing that the Chinese do. Now, granted, the Chinese, they can actually get away with a lot more because of how their government is structured. However, our government is doing as much as it can within the confines of the law and sometimes outside of the confines of the law. But in order to get to that point, you're probably bankrupt in court from just being constantly dragged through the court. The government has plenty of money to waste on persecuting you. You, on the other hand, don't have that much money. So again, it's no wonder the Biden administration isn't so quick to criticize these protesters if they could do that, they would too. They're doing everything they can already without triggering massive riots, I guess, and without being too illegal by our laws. And that's also, you know, Chinese government, they're known for censorship. Well, the Biden administration does that too. They've admitted it. In the last segment, I opened up with them talking about how they're doing censorship. Now, the First Amendment does not give them the power to censor you. So instead, they're outsourcing to private firms, the firms that control your means of communication, big tech, Facebook, Twitter, all of them. The Biden administration is going to them and saying, hey, we can't censor ourselves, so you censor for us. It's should be just as much of a First Amendment violation, but because it's a privately owned firm operating on behalf of the government, I guess they get away with it. Although, isn't the government colluding with corporations like that fascism, the sort of thing that the Democrat Party accuses Republicans of being? Well, you'd think so, but they're Democrats, and I guess this is dangerous misinformation that I'm spreading, and I would get banned from Twitter in the olden days before Elon Musk took over. And again, that's why Elon Musk is such a big threat to them, just because he allows this sort of free speech to happen. But then you also have Western companies that are perfectly happy to be the censors of the government, much like... So again, it effectively has the same power as the Chinese government, and boy, these companies can do a lot to you. It came out that Google, for example, it buries emails from conservative sources. If a Republican candidate sent you a fundraising email, most likely it got buried, whereas Democrat candidates always got through. And also there have been instances where even text messages, depending on what your phone carrier is, text messages from certain sources containing certain links, like links to Gateway Pundit articles, for example, were buried. They wouldn't allow them through. All this has happened. But again, it's private companies who own this stuff. So I guess that allows them to get away with censoring people. But it's all at the behest of one political party. So it's like a very soft version of what China does. We don't have the same genocide as China does. We're not welding people inside their homes. People aren't going to concentration camps because they said the wrong thing about the government. But it seems that the Biden administration and just the left-wingers in big tech are doing as much as they can to bring some of that here. And gee whiz, as far as concentration camps go, remember, I've talked about before on the show, a poll showed a majority of Democrats actually were in favor of concentration camps for the unvaccinated. There was an actual poll done of Democrats where they admitted this. So it's not like I'm just sitting here fear-mongering out my rear end. This is all factual stuff, polls backing it up, that we've seen. So again, no wonder the Biden administration is silent as far as China goes. More Silver Joe Show after this break.
Intuit and the Sioux Family Foundation are really meeting the growing need for financial education based on the resources that we're bringing to schools. You know, Intuit, who is a global financial technology platform, serves over 100 million customers through our financial products, including TurboTax and QuickBooks and Credit Karma and MailChimp. And for 40 years, we've been helping our customers achieve financial confidence. We're taking that experience and ultimately using it to create these free educational resources that we're bringing to schools. And we're partnering with the Sioux Family Foundation specifically on our personal finance workshops that we're making available to school districts across the country with an initial focus on school districts in underserved communities. So for more information, teachers or administrators or even parents can go to our website, intuit.com/financial basics.
The holidays are here, but finding the right tech gift and staying within your budget can be challenging. And with more people working from home, there is increased demand for productivity tools and technologies that can help make us more efficient. The ScanSnap iX1300 helps me digitize, organize, and share documents with the press of a button. Budgeting and finding the best tech gifts can be challenging. So to give myself more flexibility, I use PayPal Pay Later, which lets me spread out payments over time to better suit my budget. And these days, more people are embracing experiences over things. Rosetta Stone is the perfect gift for anyone who wants to learn a language, connect with loved ones, or learn some helpful phrases before their next international trip. And for the kids, I'm always looking for something that'll stimulate their brains and develop healthy habits. Kindle Paperwhite Kids is the perfect option for kids and is purpose-built for reading, which means there are no distractions from other apps, games, or videos. For more info on everything I talked about, follow me on Instagram or Twitter at TechLifeSteph.
What is dedication?
I am the father of a 9-year-old little girl and a 6-year-old little boy. And I find fatherhood both relentlessly challenging and relentlessly rewarding. My daughter is biological and my son is adopted. I love them both so much. From the morning when you wake up to putting them to bed at night, and every moment in between, it really is so special. And boy, is it exhausting. One thing that I fear about being a parent is the future for my children. I think a parent's job is to protect our children, but also prepare them for the world so they become good, kind human beings. But I'm also hopeful that the future holds a more inclusive and compassionate world for them.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
My baby brother, a father.
Come on, it's time for his nap.
Whoa, he can't sleep on his stomach. Babies should always sleep on their backs in a safety-approved crib, and the sleep area should be clear of blankets, toys, and other loose or soft items. It reduces the risk of SIDS.
SIDS?
You know, sudden infant death syndrome.
Guess I need to start studying up on safe sleep for little man here. Being his favorite uncle comes with big responsibilities.
For more information, visit safetosleep.nichd.nih.gov, sponsored by the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development. You want to give your baby everything, so start with a safe sleep area. Babies younger than one should always be placed to sleep on their backs on a firm and flat surface, like a safety-approved crib. And keep blankets, pillows, and other soft or loose items out of the crib when the baby is in it. Learn more about safe sleep for babies at safetosleep.nichd.nih.gov. sponsored by the Eunice Kennedy Shriver National Institute of Child Health and Human Development.
Thank you for staying with the Silk or Joe Show through this hour. We are joined now by Martin Duger, co-author with Bill O'Reilly of the number one New York Times bestselling killing series, with his latest book being Taking Berlin, The Bloody Race to Defeat the Third Reich. Martin Duger, appreciate you being here. How are you today? Well, I think he is doing all right. Martin Duger, how are you?
I'm good. Can you hear me?
Yep, we can hear you now. Thank you.
Okay, good. All right, perfect.
This seems to be an almost annual occurrence now. We had you on the show last year talking about Taking Paris. I'm assuming that's your previous book. So now we're at Taking Berlin, The Bloody Race to Defeat the Third Reich. What's this about? Well, I guess the end of World War II, but in what way?
It's interesting. Yeah, it is World War II. It kind of picks up, you know, Taking Paris ends with the liberation of Paris in August 1944. I backtrack a little bit to tell the story of the last year of the war. So I go back to D-Day, which is June 1944, and take the story all the way through to the end of the war in May 1945.
Hmm. So is this just thematically part of what you were consuming from Taking Paris, or how did you decide to go with Taking Berlin instead of, I don't know, the Battle of the Bulge or something like that in between?
Well, you know, the way that I ended Taking Paris, it kind of makes it sound like the liberation of Paris was the end of the war, and it was for people in Paris, but there was still a lot of great stuff coming, you know, including the Battle of the Bulge, which took place, you know, Christmas, you know, was it about 5 months, six months after the fall of Paris. So I wanted to tell that story because when I got done with Paris, I really didn't feel like I was finished writing about the topic. I really enjoyed it. I loved the way the story was unfolding, and I wanted to take that narrative thread of the heroes of Taking Paris, you know, Winston Churchill, George Patton, all those people, you know, Dwight Eisenhower, and I wanted to tell their story a little bit longer. You know, they're just fun people to write about, and I thought I'd dig a little deeper and see what I could find.
How much of this topic did you know beforehand going in? Did you have enough just in your head that you could write it off the top of your head?
No, I think even though, you know, I love history, I'm a historian, history is such a broad topic that you really can't know much more than the brushstrokes on a regular basis. So, for instance, you know, I knew about Operation Market Garden, which was this huge parachute operation in September 1944, trying to get to Germany in a hurry. I knew about the Battle of the Bulge. I knew that the Russians were attacking Berlin at the same time as the Allies. But everything else I needed, you know, that was all I knew. That's the whole year of the war, and that's the kind of, like I said, the broad brushstrokes. So I wanted to kind of fill in the details, you know, teach myself a little bit. You know, every one of these books is kind of like a, you know, master's degree in the topic, but at the same time, I wanted to tell the story in a new and original way so that people like myself who thought they knew the topic would take a great deal of joy in learning more and, you know, turning the pages. I like to write in a real fast-paced style, so, you know, I wanted to bring the reader into the story with me.
Going into it, did you learn anything that changed what you thought about the events and for perhaps even changed a little bit how you envisioned the narrative going?
Well, you know, the way that I sold the book, you know, and whenever you have an idea, you have to pitch it to your publisher and you know, kind of convince them this is the best story to tell, was that there was this race to Berlin between the Allies and the Russians. Soviets. And, you know, and there was, because, you know, we had D-Day, they had something even much larger called Operation Bagration a few weeks later. And we began this race towards Berlin. And the way I set the book up was, you know, it's going to be this heated, you know, one side moves forward, another side moves forward, and then we get to Berlin, and who's going to get there first? And that was the way that it originally was for both sides, you know, all through the summer and through the fall of 1944, it was this heated race to see who was going to get to Berlin first. And then after Yalta in February 1945, when we basically told the Russians, you know, this is, we're going to stop, you know, 100 yards west of Berlin and you can have Berlin, it kind of took some of the, you know, the thrill. And so I had to find a way to keep the action tense and keep it going. And it just, because that's the fun thing about writing history. History unfolds its own way. And so as a storyteller, it's one thing to, you know, predict, like, this is how I would like to history unfold, have history unfold, but history does its own thing, you know, as we all see in our own daily lives. So had to kind of work around that story to keep the action moving and keep everything excited, because there certainly was plenty of action for the story.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure some of the generals, too, Allied generals, might have been felt a little constrained and tried to do their own miniature races. If they couldn't get to Berlin, they'd see how far they could get anyway.
Well, Patton certainly did. You know, Patton, you know, Montgomery, Bernardo Montgomery, the British field marshal, was advancing through the Low Countries, you know, Belgium, Holland, into Germany on the northern side, and Patton was further south doing his own advance into Germany, very much racing Montgomery, trying to beat Montgomery there. He wanted to get all the glory for being the first general into Berlin. And when he was told to stop his troops and let the Soviets have Berlin, he kind of turned a little bit to the south, further south, and kept pushing, because his whole idea was we needed to push the Soviets back as far as we possibly could, because they would gobble up as much territory as they could. So he actually pushed into Czechoslovakia. He pushed through Germany into Czechoslovakia before he was told to not only stop but backtrack and give that territory to the Soviets.
Now, at the time, was there any foresight as to the Cold War? Did they think that the alliance with the Soviets would be temporary? Or was all of this just, let's get the war done, worry about the rest later?
Well, that's the thing that I came to know, though. You know, the big reveal to me about 1945 was once we got a toehold in Europe with D-Day. We already had troops in Italy, but they were pinned down. So those troops moving inland, once we gained that toehold, once we started moving on Paris, the talk switched from D-Day and fighting the battle and getting into Europe, and it switched to like getting home for Christmas. It switched to, what is the world going to be like after World War II? What's going to happen to, you know, the order? Like, we knew Britain was going to have to give up all of her territories, you know, all the far-flung colonies, because, you know, the Japanese had taken, you know, there was an independence movement. But I think the key thing is that, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, our president at the time, was the most political man you could ever meet in your whole life. And somehow Soviet dictator Joseph Stalin bamboozled him into thinking he was a nice, trustworthy guy, and that the Soviets were going to liberate these countries, then immediately, you know, like Poland and Hungary and Bulgaria, you know, liberate them, then you know, move out, and which is not what happened. And that was the big sadness of the book. And at the very end, I've got a speech from Winston Churchill where he predicts, just as he had predicted World War II as early as 1930, he predicts the Cold War in 1945 in a speech. 1946, I'm sorry, in a speech in Fulton, Missouri, with Harry Truman in attendance, basically telling everybody this new thing, this Iron Curtain that the Soviets are spreading throughout Europe is going to be the cause of our next big conflict. And, of course, he was right.
Wow. Yeah, very, very intelligent man predicting the next world war and the Iron Curtain falling. Actually, the show's starting to wrap up right now. So where can we get a copy of your book, Taking Berlin, The Bloody Race to Defeat the Third Reich?
Well, you can just go online, go to Amazon or any or BarnesandNoble.com, any of the great booksellers. And, of course, you can go to your local bookstore. And or go to my website, martindugard.com. It'll give you much more information.
All right, Martin Dugard, appreciate you being on the Silk Road Joe Show today. Listeners, appreciate you tuning into the program. Got to pitch our own website, mainstreetradionetwork.com. You'll find about this program and the Alan Nathan Show on there as well. And also, we are on social media, Getter, GETTR.com, at Silk Road Joe Show. Be seeing you.
The opinions you hear on the Main Street Radio Network are those of the host, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of the station, Main Street Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Main Street Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. So please, consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about Main Street Radio Network, contact us at 703-719-0433 or at our website, mainstreetradionetwork.com.